Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on Nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at LexusofLexington.com. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
On Breadbox Media, this is Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight.
We're talking today about Robinson Crusoe and how it has been censored and how many versions of it that are available today for young people and adults to read have been abridged in a way that censors out any mention of God or religion. Now, Philip Zaleski observes in his article that it's not difficult to see Robinson Crusoe as a parable of our own condition. And that's how I've been presenting it here. Robinson Crusoe was shipwrecked, and we are too, cut off from the mainland of religious tradition, shipwrecked on the shoals of secularism. Our culture as a whole has suffered the same fate as Defoe's book, a systematic purging of religious content. What happened to Robinson Crusoe as a book is indicative of what's happening elsewhere in general. But Zaleski succumbs to another era of our times in that he apologizes for suggesting in any way that there's a conspiracy. Oh, no, it can't be a conspiracy. Many people think we've just been experiencing a cultural drift, a tide that goes in and out. Well, I have to disagree with that. There's a whole nother literature, and it's nonfiction literature, that I delve into from time to time on Setting the Record Straight. It's accurate histories, and there's plenty of them. None dare call it a conspiracy, so let's don't. Let's just call it willfully misrepresenting history and altering artworks, much like smashing stained glass windows, for political or propaganda purposes. There's a better word for it. It's called iconoclasm, but that word, too, has lost its original meaning. It means smashing icons, smashing sacred objects. So censoring the content of Robinson Crusoe is iconoclasm. It's an old theme of human history, iconoclasm. There's a whole literature, volumes and volumes, on the subject of what happened to our culture, the subversion of our culture in the 20th century. The documentation is extensive and responsible, and it includes things like the KGB archives, which document in great detail how our culture was subverted. It's a mistake to call it a conspiracy, because it's not descriptive. It's too big, it's too public, but like the emperor's new clothes, it just cannot be seen. The term conspiracy is so degraded now that to use it discredits oneself. What it was an open, large-scale project to secularize our culture. It was achieved by persons who became famous for doing so. I think instantly of Otto von Bismarck and his culture comp, his culture war against the Catholic Church in Germany in the 1800s. There's others, well described in responsible history books, the Frankfurt School, John Dewey, Stalin, Ion Pachepka, who participated in it, converted to Christianity and wrote a book about his efforts with the Stasi and the KGB to create a false history about Pope Pius XII, which is commonly believed. A very artful disinformation is an information that is more believable than reality. Reality is often a little bit improbable. Therefore, it's not very hard to construct artful lies. When Zaleski writes this, quote, "At no time, I am convinced, was there a deliberate suppression of Robinson's religion in order to buttress secular claims. unquote. Well, if the alteration of Robinson Crusoe and the scissoring out of his religion and mentions of God was not done consciously in order to buttress secular claims, then for what reason did it occur? It's obvious that that was the reason. The man with the scissors could not have been unconscious, did too good a job of it. I do agree it's not a conspiracy, if by conspiracy we mean something secret. It was quite public. But Philip Zaleski has done an admirable job in his First Things article. I know my disagreement is a little quibble. Perhaps we should call it a campaign. If so, it was a campaign to put us asleep. Because how asleep must we be if we have an inability to read history with any rigor and see that we have an allergy to the sacred? Zaleski includes some contemporary ideas about Robinson Crusoe. Quote, this is from J.R. Hammond in a Defoe Companion, who announces, today we no longer read the story as a religious parable, but recognize it as an allegory of the human condition. Hammond takes for granted a divorce between religion and the, quote, human condition. Still worse is Martin Green's 1990 appraisal of a compilation of Methodist sermons entitled The Gospel of Robinson Crusoe. This compilation reads Defoe's tale for what it is, a story of spiritual travail. The book came out in 1955. This book, says Green, was, quote, simply out of date. It was a mere oddity. Any audits it may have had in 1955 must have belonged to a special group out of step with a majority. Such, Green assures us, is the consensus of, quote, men and women of letters, unquote. So what do people in the 20th century make of Robinson Crusoe anyway? They see him as a Marxist hero, for one thing. In 1933, the Soviet Writers' Circle declared Defoe, along with Jules Verne and Jonathan Swift, as one of the three great four novelists of the cause. Presumably, Stalinists took their cue from Marx, who declared Robinson Crusoe in Das Kapital, of his prayers and the like we take no account. Marx instead upheld Robinson as the representative of, quote, a community of free individuals carrying on their work with the means of production in common, unquote. Rousseau, that old rascal, by contrast, imagined Robinson as a prototype of the noble savage. Of course he did. Other critics have seen in Defoe's book a parable about imperialism or social progress or even Oedipal conflicts. But the truth is, they're reading Robinson as a lesson in economics or psychology or pedagogy is akin to reading Moby Dick for its tips on whale harvesting. What does it really matter? Why care about these distortions of Robinson Crusoe? It does matter. Philip Zaleski gives five reasons. I like the first one. He said it matters first of all because truth matters. I suppose we all agree about that. Secondly, because Robinson Crusoe matters. Robinson Crusoe matters in its own right as a splendid novel that deserves to remain intact. Yes, this is the argument against the image smashers, the iconoclasts. And Robinson matters, he goes on, in the history of the novel. Many critics count Defoe's masterpiece as not just the most famous novel in the world, but the first novel in the world. This judgment depends on definition, of course, and you could offer the earlier Don Quixote. Nonetheless, all critics agree that Robinson Crusoe stands as a primordial example of form. It is also unquestionably the first English novel, progenitor of a glorious stream, whose current encompasses Fielding, Dickens, Graham, and Lewis. There are some loose ends in the plot. The text is long-winded, repetitious, sometimes crude. Dickens pointed out that Defoe handles emotion poorly. He said, Robinson is the only example of a universally popular book that can make no one laugh and no one cry. Its structure sags. Edgar Allan Poe remarked that we close the book and are quite satisfied that we could have written as well ourselves. Yet, Robinson Crusoe shines with power and beauty, power that stems from the universality of its hero's plight. It's almost mythical, so elemental that it approaches myth, beauty that lies in the majesty of his redemption. Defoe may have been a little bit conscious of his role as father of the novel, because he gives us at the very origin of the genre, this work, that addresses the origin and destiny of human beings, of justice, freedom, of the state, civilization itself, and he identifies a source of these essential matters just where they must be found, in the very origin of all things. Zaleski gives us a third reason. It matters. Because the art of the novel itself matters. Although now movies are more popular than novels, novels remain first when it comes to intellectual clout. For example, would you rather get an Oscar or the Nobel Prize for Literature? Moreover, the novel is the art of the public square, with no competition. By the very nature of its production and distribution, the novel cannot be privatized, as can say painting, which made a disastrous swerve towards subjectivity after World War I. And now no one takes it seriously anymore. There are a lot of bad novels, but good novels like Brother Karamazov, Pale Fire and Silence, The Power and the Glory by Graham Greene, invariably deal with the relationships between people or between people and God and the moral implications of these relationships. It's important that a novelist works alone. Each novel is as individual and as universal as a prayer. The fourth reason is our discussion matters because art matters. It matters because beauty matters. And the truths matter toward which beauty points our way. You might say that a good test of a culture, the litmus test, or a society, is its sense of beauty. Real beauty is a matter of rightness. Real beauty always unfolds in a moral landscape. It reflects its order, intelligence, and harmonious dispositions, these same qualities in their transcendent state. Zaleski feels that real beauty never divides, degrades, or corrupts. It weds, elevates, and purifies. He says beauty always leads to God, for God is beautiful and he loves beauty. For beauty summons all things to itself, as Dionysus observed. You could put it this way. Real beauty converts. Once conversion takes place, as Defoe shows in Robinson Crusoe, the human being expresses his love for the divine order through the beauty of his own creations. Might be straw basket, might be a symphony. In this enterprise, we draw nearer to God's mysterious working. Here's how the Catechism of the Catholic Church puts it. To the extent that it is inspired by truth and love of being, art bears a certain likeness to God's activity and what he has created. Back to talking about Robinson Crusoe. The book that Philip Zaleski loved so much as a child, ran read as an adult, and found out that it had been horribly mutilated. All the parts about religion and God were scissored out. It's what they used to do to Shakespeare, clean him up. A man named Boulder did it. It's called boulderizing something. It means taking out any offensive parts. And often that process removes the very lifeblood and vitals of whatever artwork is being operated on. You know, there's some interesting things about the book. It has a subtitle I really love. Listen to this. The Life and Strange Surprising Adventures of Robinson Crusoe of York, Mariner, who lived 8 and 20 years all alone in an uninhabited island on the coast of America, near the mouth of the great river of Orinoco. Having been cast on shore by shipwreck, wherein all the men perished but himself, with an account how he was at last strangely delivered by pirates. Unquote. It sort of unfolds like a pair of outstretched arms, as if trying to grasp the width of this great world that is described in it. Well, the year was 1719. An exploration of the New World was all the rage, and the exotic content of Robinson Crusoe seemed deftly suited to the times. The story of literature's most famous castaway sold well among Defoe's fellow Englishmen. But there's something else that appears to be at work in the worldly subtitle of Defoe's most celebrated work of fiction, which is also one of the first English novels. Carefully spading one detail upon another, Defoe sounds like he's trying to plant the reader in a rich sediment of fact. From the first page, Robinson Crusoe conveys sort of a documentary power. It's like a wildlife special. The question is, was Daniel Defoe trying to fool us into believing that the story was real? The answer is, yes, he was. But it was a hoax. It was sometimes dry, like a police report. But then there was always a surprise around the corner. And it keeps you interested to see what's going to happen next. So his hoax worked, he was believed, and he probably sold a lot more copies than he would have otherwise. Of course, only some people believed it. Some people have accused Defoe of going too far in creating the novel Solid Sense of Reality. So, well, of course, a lot of readers believed that there really was somewhere a real flesh-and-blood Robinson Crusoe. The truth is that Daniel Defoe loved subterfuge. He promoted the illusion by telling readers that Robinson Crusoe had been written by Crusoe himself. It included a preface asserting the story as a, quote, just history of fact. We describe it as a novel now, of course, but it wasn't born that way. It was a hoax. Well, let's be a little charitable about his tactics, because he's writing novels when the form was new, and you could say that his casting of fiction as fact was simply a daring experiment within an emerging genre. It's hardly over. Look at Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code, which so many people believe is realer than reality. If Daniel Defoe had been alive in the 20th century, he would have been an excellent employee of the KGB in Russia, putting out false stories about everybody that were believable, exciting, and cool enough to be accepted. Let's think about the Daily Journal he kept for a minute. It was not just a record of despair. Keeping the journal was an answer to the despair. His pen, as much as his axe or his musket, became a tool of survival. Robinson Crusoe, like the voice behind any masterpiece, was writing for his life. Well, let's go back to Philip Zelensky and his concern over the novel being changed and having huge parts of it cut out. He had five reasons that he thought it was important that this not be done. Earlier, we discussed the first four. Zelensky gives a fifth reason all this matters. He says it's because his culture matters. Secularism has muddied the relationship between religion and culture. Even the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language gives this definition for culture. As the totality of socially transmitted behavior patterns, arts, beliefs, institutions, and all other products of human work and thought characteristic of a community or population. One thing on the list was beliefs. Are beliefs nothing more than a product of human work and thought? Oh, not so. Not entirely. Not for those who admit the possibility of divine revelation. Culture is the medium through which we hear the muffled voice of God. Religion without culture is dead. According to Christopher Dawson, that historian you know I prize, according to Christopher Dawson, a society which has lost its religion becomes sooner or later a society which has lost its culture. The reverse also holds. Without culture, religion will not long survive. The Benedictine monasteries were oases of the Catholic faith of Europe and withstood the barbarian centuries. These days, culture forms the battleground between the sacred and the profane. What happens next will have been generated on the playing fields of culture, with the writers, artists, artisans, novelists, musicians, etc. Everything in a civilization is downstream of culture, comes from the culture, finds its source in it. Now, political activity does have its role to play, but we can pass all the laws we want, and they won't do any good if our culture remains marooned on a secular island. For writers, artists, intellectuals, culture is the ark. There can be no other. It was in an ailing culture that brought about the cultural decomposition, the breakdown of our families, and all the ruins that we see around us. There's cause for hope, because the way we got into this mess is the same way we'll get out of it. The way to get out of it is to go back the same way we got in it, through the media and through the arts. It was the storm of an adverse culture that shipwrecked us on a desert island. Culture must bring us out as well. And this is our hope. We can despair, but it was done rather easily. It was a massive effort, but a very directly and simply constructed effort. The media was the powerful tool that was used to subvert us, and we can be restored using the media. That's what real life radio is all about. That's what the Catholic media is all about. You really ought to support us. Become a cultural warrior. We're using the media to restore, to heal, to make our culture robust again by restoring the truth to it. Now, you can heal culture wounds with surgery. You can cut off from the large social mass and establish your own insular subcultures, alive to the presence of God. The Amish, the Hutterites, the Shakers come to mind. Doing it that way would discourage most human beings for reasons both practical and moral. Most of us are committed to a larger society, and I think we have good reason to hope. There's strong possibilities for the renewal of a genuinely spiritual culture. People are waking up. Baby boomers who abandoned the churches 20 years ago have streamed back into the pews. You hear Gregorian chants in the airwaves. Religion is re-erupting after a long suppression, the Reconquista. It's a Reconquista, a reconquering. Zaleski makes the humorous remark that at this moment, more angels are clustered on the New York Times bestseller list than the head of any medieval pin. Science fiction has kept alive the eschatological imagination in this skeptical age. Spielberg's E.T. is a transparent Christ figure. As a matter of fact, in fantasy fiction, dragons are on the rebound. And in video games, can St. George be far behind? Even New Age spirituality, anathema to traditionalists, can be considered a welcome change from the secularism of the age. But we're experiencing a rejection of orthodoxy. And that has become a nearly inevitable phase in adolescent development. But people are finding their way back, sometimes around the barn, but they are. Sometimes they make an excursion into New Age or other alternative religions before they come back. How long can one dally with pastel and pink Aquarian cherubim for longing for an encounter with Gabriel's stately beauty? How long can one read poorly written channeled scripture before finding relief in the Bible? Everyone hungers for real substantial spiritual food. We should make it available. One thing we can do is retain whatever is worthy in our shipwreck culture. We can, we must, turn to tradition for guidance. As Robinson turned to the remnants of Christian England strewn along his beach, we're not recommending we returning wholesale to the past. It's a big task. When has it happened in history that a secular culture rebuilt itself on sacred foundations? I'd like to find that example. We need solutions as ingenious as any devised by our industrious hero, Robinson Crusoe. Like him, we must never despair. Like him, we have to find strength in prayer. You have to look at the damage we've done, that we have uprooted God from our homes, schools, books, arts. It's as if we've been washed overboard. Somewhere the boat of Peter, the bark of Peter, the Catholic Church, searches for us, waiting for us to climb aboard. God, the master mariner, never abandons his children. It's comforting to think about Robinson Crusoe finding salvation in a situation far more desperate than ours. For Setting the Record Straight, this is Chuck Coughlin. A favorite author of mine, Walter de la Mare, made a remark about Robinson Crusoe. He wrote, "Even to think of this admirable hermit is to be cheerful and to take heart of grace."
Redbox Media programming is brought to you by...
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way. Buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land Gift Shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.